Don't underestimate your own power to think for yourself, for goodness sake. I mean, we can't just hand this all over, especially in today's world, to these politicians who are sometimes seem to be fighting a different fight than you and I are. You know, think for yourself and express yourself. Find ways to do that. Maybe it's too confusing. Maybe with modern communications, there are too many different opinions flying around. I reserve the right to have my own opinion, it seems to me, and that I hope everybody else does too.
As a CIA officer in Iraq during the war, I lived in a world where power meant weapons, money, and force. And yet, I kept encountering a deeper power. Policies changed, governments shifted, military plans often failed, but connection to each other, to the earth, and to something larger than ourselves kept proving more powerful than violence and destruction. I'm Janessa Gans Wilder, and this is Peace is Power, a podcast exploring how peace will change your life and our world. Each week, I speak with leaders, artists, activists, and spiritual thinkers around one core question. What if true power is not domination, but connection? Welcome to Peace is Power. My guest today is John Negroponte, who served for more than four decades in the U.S. Foreign Service, including as U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, and as the first Director of National Intelligence. This conversation is especially meaningful to me because I served under Ambassador Negroponte in Baghdad during the Iraq War. And one of the things I remember most was how steady and unflappable he was, even in the middle of crises. He had a way of keeping perspective and widening the frame no matter what. That's very much the spirit he brings to this conversation. He sees this as an uncertain time, but not an unprecedented one. Drawing on history, he believes we've lived through dark periods before, and that the U.S. will likely find its footing again. I'll say at the outset that I don't fully agree. I think we may be living through something more destabilizing than he does. But this doesn't make me pessimistic. I think hard times can force our growth and that periods of upheaval open the door to deeper change. In this conversation, we talk about war, diplomacy, the United Nations, civil society, the role of everyday citizens, and what peace requires in a world shaped so often by force. Here's my conversation with Ambassador John Negroponte. Ambassador Negroponte, welcome.
Thank you very much.
It's an honor to have you.
It's good to see you.
So since I've had the privilege of serving under you in Baghdad, this conversation feels very meaningful to me. And I want to start with a distinct memory of you when you were the ambassador to Iraq and I was your note taker for a meeting with an Iraqi minister because the meeting was going to be in French, which I speak. And this memory is of this minister, this short, squat woman, and you in the other chair, tall, and she was so on fire and impassioned and fiery discussing the issue that we were discussing that day. And you were tall, cool, calm, and collected. And you were taking it all in, but you were just completely unruffled. And I saw this quality in you again and again, even in crisis situations. And I just wanted to understand, it seemed like this ability to separate reaction from response, and I wanted to know where that quality came from.
Well, by the time we worked together, when I was ambassador in Iraq, I was over 65 years old. I don't remember exactly what age I was, but I entered the Foreign Service when I was 21 years old. So in the end, I had 44 years experience. Well, you know, I'd seen the movie many times before, and it was a matter of experience. I was just like everybody else at the beginning, was nervous, was afraid of making mistakes. I couldn't speak publicly as well as I did towards the end. So I think experience is probably the most important factor. It's nothing that I believe was innate in me. I think it was practice.
Looking out at the state of our world right now, Ambassador, do you still feel that same level-headedness, that same coolness? Or, you know, people are talking about these are unprecedented times and everyone's got their hair on fire. If this were a meeting and the state of the world were opposite you, how would you be reacting? How would you be responding?
Well, people have had their hair on fire before. You know, I came over here as an infant with my parents just at the beginning of World War II. Literally, the war had been going on for about 3 weeks. You know, those were dark times. Nobody knew where the world was headed then, believe me. And we've been through crises throughout the time of our history and history before that. So while it's difficult as you go through it, and, you know, you always worry whether this may be some kind of apocalyptic moment, usually we come out at the other end. We get across whatever difficulty it is, although there's some very difficult experiences. I guess perhaps for the United States, the most traumatic was the Civil War. Imagine yourself living at the time of the Civil War and wondering what was going to happen to our country. I mean, 600,000 people were killed in battle during that war. Just incredible. In proportional terms, that's the most serious conflict we've ever been through. And what view of the world did people have as we were going through that terrible experience?
Hey, listeners, if you're wanting to go deeper in your peacebuilding journey, come visit us at Euphrates.org. Euphrates Institute is the organization I founded after my time serving in Iraq during the war. We offer courses, resources, and a global community of peacebuilders from more than 60 countries who are learning how to practice peace within and without. You can learn more at Euphrates.org. So you really are able to maintain that level of detachment or distance. Do you tend to put things in that larger scope of history? Or is it because you yourself have seen so many ups and downs that you sort of have faith that it will come out right in the other end? What grounds you in that?
Well, it's a great question. I think it's a combination of these things. First of all, just because I tried, as I just did, to put this into perspective doesn't mean I'm indifferent to what's happening at all. In fact, I would agree with you. We're going through an extremely difficult time, and I would say dangerous even, because there are a lot of uncertainties about which way things are going to go. And anytime you've got rockets and drones and all these tools of war flying around, there's danger, especially when it involves important powers and ones even that have nuclear weapons. So Israel has nuclear weapons, the U.S. has them, the Russians over there in Ukraine, they have nuclear weapons. We don't know exactly what Iran has, but they probably don't have nuclear weapons at the moment. But yeah, we're going through dangerous times. There's no question about it. Now, do I have faith it's going to come out all right in the end? Well, I have a reasonable amount of confidence that we will survive this and we'll get things back on track. But, you know, that's just a prediction. It's not a certainty by any means. You've got to act as if you can get it back on track. If you sort of lose hope and just throw up your arms, that doesn't help anything.
Yeah. I'd love to drill down a little bit more on that, especially with thinking about these larger shifts in humanity. So, you know, when I was thinking about it, we have the most conflicts going on in the world since World War II. We're seeing a decline in all the democracy measures around the world and at home by many factors: the press, justice system, dysfunction in Congress, rising inequality. We're also seeing the U.S. playing in this role of disrupting these historic alliances and promoting a might makes right worldview. So I guess in this broader spectrum, is this a phase that will sort of, you know, work out, or is this a shift in the underlying world order which I know you're reading about, you know, since World War II, is this a shift? And what does that mean for the UN? I know you served there. Help us put this into context of what we're seeing, a temporary blip or like a fundamental shift of the world order?
Wonderful question. And I'm going to give you an answer. And this isn't a cop-out, but I think to some extent, it depends. Right now, we're experiencing, I think, an attempt by our current president to sort of change the world order. I mean, I think that's what he's trying to do. I personally think he's not correct in trying to do that. And I believe, just in political terms, that he's not going to succeed because I think he's going to be beaten the way he should be beaten and the way those ideas should be defeated, which is at the polls. So I think a very important thing to watch is what happens in the midterm elections. It doesn't look like it's going very well for him at the moment, but I don't know. We'll have to wait and see what actually happens. But it's in our hands. It's not out of the control of the American people to help decide what the answer to your question is going to be.
Well, not necessarily, because it may be that these alliances, there's already mistrust that's been sowed. You know, Carney's talking about remaking the world order. And what is a different way forward for middle powers? So
they're talking about it. I don't know whether they can achieve it. But I could see why they would do it. I mean, why wouldn't Canada be tempted to try something else, given the insults to which they've been subjected when a president comes in and says, well, you'd be a great 51st state kind of statement and stuff like that. Very disrespectful of their identity and their sovereignty. And also, these are terrific allies. The Canadians have been by our side just about every step of the way. So right now, I think people are wondering what is going to happen to the world order. What I'm doing is venturing a modest prediction, which is that try as he might, I do not believe the president will succeed in changing it. And we will, once he has left office, which he will do at the end of these 4 years, we will revert a little bit back to type. That's what I believe will happen. Now you're going to say, well, are you just whistling in the dark? Or do you have a solid basis for believing that? Maybe it's a little bit of both. I mean, our record so far is pretty good, the political record of the United States. But there are danger signs there. This has been a much more disruptive period than we've had before. That's true.
And sometimes disruption can open up thought for new ways of thinking, for new creativity. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about reform to the United Nations. Is there a reimagining of the Security Council that we need? So, I mean, on the one hand, this is not business as usual, what does creative way forwards look like? That could actually open up interesting conversations for much needed reform.
Well, on the UN, I mean, two things about it. First of all, I'm a great supporter. I was ambassador of the United Nations. I've studied the history of that institution, and I worked in it. I worked on the Security Council as the U.S. representative. I was there for, I guess, almost 3 years. And I think it has served us well over the years, but it's not a panacea. The UN is only what the member countries decide it's going to be. And so there are times when the UN wasn't able to deal with the problems that existed. During the Vietnam War, for example, we never had Vietnam on the UN agenda, really. It was done completely to the side of the United Nations. And we've a little bit had that experience with Ukraine now. You know, when you've got one country that's sort of out of step with everybody else or many of the others, and it does what it wants to do, and it happens to be a permanent member of the Security Council. Now, some people want to change the Security Council. I tell you, I never met so many people who thought that the answer to everything was to change the makeup of the Security Council. And frankly, I just think that's nonsense. I mean, why is everybody's behavior going to change because all of a sudden so-and-so has got a seat in the UN Security Council? It just doesn't compute.
And not only that, the existing powers would never vote to expand it.
Well, that's for sure. I mean, I don't think they will. I mean, I looked at this and I said, I'm not sure a president of the United States should spend that much of his or her time trying to persuade other countries to accept an amendment to the UN Charter to get rid of the veto. Well, the history of the issue is that the U.S. Congress, which was Republican-controlled at the time during the end of World War II, they were not going to approve the United Nations Charter unless there was a veto. As Senator Vandenberg, very famous man, who cooperated with Roosevelt and Truman, but that was their condition. There's got to be a veto.
And that's what created the veto, or was the veto already an idea?
No, that's what created the veto.
And then who had the idea to share it with the other four powers?
You'll remember that the League of Nations was disapproved by the United Nations. And so, you know, Roosevelt was very sensitive to the challenge of ensuring that Congress ratified the UN Charter. And that was the main condition of Mr. Vandenberg. So, you know, can we change that today? I kind of doubt it. So can you expand the UN to have more permanent members? Well, I suppose you could. But, you know, it's a Herculean effort to amend the Charter of the United Nations, because you got to get it through both. I forget the exact procedure, but you have to have the approval of the Security Council and all the permanent members. If any one of them vetoes the reform, then it doesn't go through.
But at the same time, if as an institution it doesn't stay abreast of the times, then it will just slowly be relegated to irrelevancy and other things will be done outside of it.
Yeah, I think they've done some pretty good things. I thought the peacekeeping missions they had in Africa when I was there, they did some really good work in Sierra Leone. They did it in Liberia. They had peacekeeping missions in about 8 or 10 places in Africa, some of which were really quite effective. The most effective was Sierra Leone, which when I first was briefed on the issue, when I took the job as ambassador to the United Nations, the whole country was controlled by rebels except for a few square blocks in the capital city of Freetown. And 2 or 3 years later, with help from a peacekeeping force and with British troops, Sierra Leone was sort of back under control. And I would say a reasonable success story. But people don't want to look at the success stories. They just want to, they get mad when we can't reach agreement. But it's our fault for not reaching agreement. It's not the fault of the UN as an institution, honestly. And I think you have to put more effort into getting agreements in the Security Council. George Herbert Walker Bush was not going to go into Kuwait to liberate it from Iraq in the first Gulf War unless he had the approval of the UN Security Council. And of course, he had been ambassador to the United Nations. So he, you know, he knew the issues and he knew whereof he spoke. And he decided it was going to be worth the effort of his Secretary of State, Mr. Baker, to get the approval of the other member countries. And Baker spent the busiest time of his life traveling all over to the world, to these different countries, persuading them to vote with us in the Security Council. And we got approval, despite predictions to the contrary. So if you make the effort, I think it can be rewarded. And I think the contrast between how hard we tried in the first Gulf War and how much less effort we put into it for the second Gulf War may be the difference between having gotten approval for our action or not.
And why do you think this time around there was no effort made?
You hardly hear any talk of bringing that to the United Nations. I mean, bringing that fact and that event to the Security Council. You know, it wasn't. We just did it. And I don't think this administration is inclined to go to the United Nations for this kind of action. And I think they saw it more as some sort of policing action. And well, it's a unilateral action. Nobody else joined us, really.
Right. I mean, it does show a difference in approach and tenor. It's interesting that you started with the Civil War, because it does provide that context, you know, a war on our shores, that many people killed, really the only one that there hasn't been a war since then on our shores. Do you feel like through the course of your decades in service and a student of history and world history, and I'm honestly asking this, do you feel like we are evolving as humanity? Like, you know, as Martin Luther King Jr. talks about, the arc of justice bends upward, or, you know, do you see that arc when you step back and look at our world?
No, I'm not sure I do. I think maybe it fluctuates more than that. I see certain trends that I think are important. Like in warfare, for example, And certainly in the West, no one is going to conduct a war involving Western countries that has the level of brutality and casualties that occurred during World War I. And we do a lot more to save our wounded and the avoidance of casualties.
I just took my kids to the Musée de l'Armée in Paris, you know, last weekend, and they have these mock-ups of clay modeling of World War I, of the guys in the trenches, and then the machine guns are set up and all these tunnels. And they just could not believe that anyone would willingly leave their perch from the tunnel and go out just to be mowed down. And then the gas mask, I mean, it was really sobering for them to witness that. And, you know, it was close and it was visceral and they were just right there. And
they were bogged down for years in those trenches, experiencing that same, what you're saying, the same phenomenon over and over and over again. Well, there was a British general who was very famous, because famous, notorious for having so many people to their death, a General Haig. And from wars that I've experienced in one way or another, from Vietnam, say from the Civil War, which had, I don't remember how many casualties. I think there were 600,000 people killed, something like that, to World War I and then Vietnam. I mean, the efforts we would go to save our wounded. And now, I mean, when I was in Iraq, the level of medical proficiency that we had field hospitals that could do brain surgery to save our people. But that doesn't address the other issue, which is we still got into wars, right? I mean, I'm going to try to anticipate a question of yours, which is, what does it take? What are the necessary ingredients of peace?
That's a great question. Thank you.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's one you have to think about, right?
Yes.
So I have a couple of thoughts. One is you need actually strong, healthy countries that have good governance, that behave responsibly towards their citizenry. In our way of thinking, you know, as Americans, and in a lot of other countries, we believe that one of the ways to achieve that, of course, is to have democratic governance. And we have a belief, whether it's right or not, but we believe it, I think, that the more democratic you are, and the more, like, one way it's very often put is that democracies are not likely to fight against each other.
Yeah.
It's not totally true, but there's a pretty strong element of truth. So good governance is one thing. We all should be concerned about good governance around the world, because if you have a country that's falling apart internally, it spells trouble, right?
And it spills that trouble onto its neighbors.
It does, because you get instability, you get civil war, civil strife, and then that tempts the neighbors to intervene. And then before you know it, you've got countries fighting against each other. And we see that quite often. So I think domestic stability is very important. The second element that I would put is, and I think this is important and will continue to be important, is to have sort of healthy regional institutions. You can't put all your eggs in the UN basket. I think you need organization and cooperation at a regional as well as international level. You know, it's interesting, again, because I went back and read the history of the creation of the UN. They debated whether the Security Council should have one central kind of peacekeeping function, or whether that should be delegated to regional, you know, subunits of the United Nations. Should we have a UN-type organization for the Latin America region, or for the African region, or for East Asia?
Like a peacekeeping force in each region.
Yeah, correct. But they kept it global. But we've seen a certain amount of effective action by regional organizations, and I think that's helped contribute somewhat.
What about the role of civil society?
Well, that's the other element. But it's going to have more difficulty if there's poor governance. The better the government, the better the opportunity of civil society to make a contribution. But yes, obviously, you know, how does society make its input into helping solve some of these problems? Well, one is through its various civic organizations. An interesting way to measure it is when a country slips from democracy, or at least some of the trappings of democracy, to dictatorship, their first enemies And the organizations that they take on are these organizations of civil society. I watched it in Nicaragua.
That's right.
When the Sandinistas took over, all of a sudden, the Rotary Clubs, the Lions, all these people, they started being repressed by the central government. And because it had to do with freedom of association and your ability to express your views and advocate solutions for your society and for your governments.
And same in Iraq. They were trying to put them on a registry, and they had to file, and they scrutinized their budgets. And
yeah, and NGOs were sort of by definition an enemy. Yeah, because they didn't do the exact bidding of the government. But, you know, democracy is a little bit sloppy. But it's healthy, too, if people feel they can go to their own civic organization to meet other people and talk about what's happening. That's important. But I watched these civic organizations struggle in various parts of the world. And, you know, if you want to find them, a Lions Club or a Elks Club or whoever in the People's Republic of China, you know, good luck. I don't think you'll find them.
I wanted to share another memory I have of you, if you don't mind. And it kind of goes back to what you said earlier about how do we get into wars to begin with. And to me, those conflicts affect real people. And I know you'll remember that one of our Iraqi Foreign Service nationals in the embassy was killed, Riyad. I don't know if you remember his perfect British accent. You know, every morning we'd come in and he'd say, top of the morning, cheerio. He sounded like Mary Poppins, but he left behind a young widow and several daughters. And as an Iraqi, there was no formal, you know, compensation or insurance or acknowledgement he was an Iraqi citizen. And we raised funds to support the family. And I learned later that you contributed a significant amount and that also you made possible what was such a special memorial service to honor him, and the widow was there. And yeah, it just meant a lot. And I think, you know, I bring this up because we talk about, and maybe even increasingly now in the era of drones, that this war and conflict and international relations can feel abstract and impersonal. But at the end of the day, what really struck me is that it's real people and real relationships. And even now, 20 years later, what I take away from my Iraq experience is not this particular policy or this military campaign. It is the relationships and the connections with people, whether that was in the government or on the Iraqi side, that those have endured, and the meaning, you know, the meaning that I took away from those. And so I guess my question for you is, I mean, obviously, I don't know if you wanted to say something about Riyad and your involvement, that I loved hearing about that. But was there a time when it was the human connection between you and the person on the other side that made a difference and that, you know, was more enduring and more powerful than a particular policy or, you know, something that you were handing down, but was it the relationship that made the difference?
Yeah, I don't think, in my mind, I necessarily separated these things in the sense that if you're involved in a war, one way or another, if you don't understand the personal cost of war to people, then you haven't been looking very carefully around you, it seems to me. And I've always felt impacted by personal tragedies that I was aware of. I think I remember it as much about some of the National Guard people who worked in Baghdad, because I remember there was a unit from Minnesota, and they provided security for my detail. And sometimes they came under fire, and I can remember several times where they lost, you know, 2, 3, 4 people. And I remember going to services for them and so forth. I even happened to have known some people from the same town as some of the Minnesotans that I met out there. So look, the biggest decision, the toughest decision, and every president admits it, is the decision to send young Americans into harm's way. They all tell you that. I don't think I can think of any who would deny that that isn't the most important decision they make in their lives. People need to be assured that their leaders take that part of their responsibilities extremely seriously. It's difficult. I think it's important that our civil service rules And when we hire employees in other countries, they should be entitled to similar benefits that we get for these kind of eventualities. And I don't know what arrangements might have been made since then to ensure that our national employees are incorporated into some of the same benefit systems that we have for our civil service as a whole. I know in other embassies where I work, we certainly had done that over time. It may be that in Iraq, we were sort of in transition because we'd had the Coalition Provisional Authority, and then we brought back the embassy. And I don't know how quickly we instituted all these kinds of provisions, but they should be there. I think we have an obligation to people whom we hire to provide at least more than minimal benefits of that nature.
And I was grateful that you took that on, Ambassador, because the difference between when one of our folks in our office was injured, Christy, and the deluge of calls I got from Iraqis who were so concerned, and, you know, they immediately showed up to at the U.S. Institute of Peace house there in Baghdad, and they brought her food, and they were just so solicitous of her care. And then, you know, here's Riyadh, who was killed, and to not be able to offer any kind of official recognition from the government or compensation. I was grateful that people like our office and you stepped up to do that in the absence of the government, because we were all on the same team. We were all making the same sacrifices and enduring the same threats. And it just felt like one of our teammates. And we needed to honor that.
We did. And we need to have the same spirit towards those people as we have towards our own veterans, for example. You know, look at the struggle and how long it took to get the kind of recognition and benefits for veterans in our society as we have now compared to, say, 100 years ago. And you know, look at all the people who fought, go back to the Civil War, all the people who fought in that war. I mean, incredible.
So I'd love to ask, as a diplomat, one of the qualities or skills, you know, you're dealing with people from the other side. And how did you go about creating trust? You know, trust is thrown about so much right now. I think it was Gandhi's successor, Vinoba Bhave, said wars are built from fear. Peace begins with trust. And I feel like as a diplomat, you were the pointy edge of the spear on that, in engaging with another country, with the other side, and starting to cultivate that trust. How did you personally go about doing that?
Well, I guess my first and maybe most important experience in dealing with the issue you're talking about is in 1968, when I was on the delegation to the Paris peace talks on Vietnam. And I was the liaison officer with the North Vietnamese delegation. And so not long after we got to Paris, I remember exchanging visits with my North Vietnamese counterpart. He would come to visit us in our hotel. We were all staying in the Crillon Hotel in Paris, which is right near the American Embassy. And where actually Woodrow Wilson and his delegation some decades earlier had also been situated, because the American Embassy was then also right next.
Convenient.
And then I would go out to the Communist Party of France headquarters, which had provided lodging for the North Vietnamese delegation, and see them out there. So we got to know each other. And I personally had no difficulty dealing with any Vietnamese. I mean, I'd studied the language. I spoke it not that well, but I had studied it for 44 weeks before I went out to Vietnam. And I like Vietnamese people, and I didn't see that much difference between the Northerners and the Southerners. Of course, they had their social differences and all. But so, yeah, we worked together at that level, helping set up the plenary talks and the secret talks. We had to set up secret talks also. And Mr. Harriman, Secretary Vance, we had two leaders to our delegation, Governor Averill Harriman and Secretary he was the Deputy Secretary of Defense at the time, Cyrus Vance. And Harriman was convinced that the way to get to meaningful talks was to have really secret talks with a very small number of people. And so with a CIA agent who will go by the name of Jacques. I won't say his last name. Anyway, Jacques and I went out and we went all around the circumference of Paris looking for a good safe house where we could hold meetings. And I had this obsession with finding a house where you could have a two-car garage where if the delegation came, they could drive right into the garage. We could shut the doors and they could get into the house from inside. And so Jacques and I finally found a place. And we had these meetings, and that's the way it started. And we had 2, 3, 4 hour discussions in secret with maybe about 6 or 7 people on each side of the table. And we used those meetings as sort of confidence building measures.
But what made you effective in building that confidence between, like in building that trust between the two sides? How did you bring that?
I don't know whether you bring it or whether people can tell from the way you approach your work whether you're being serious and professional and that you really want to do what you can to contribute to the success of the talks. You know, that doesn't mean necessarily preemptively giving up our position on this, that, or the other question. But sometimes I think you can tell from the demeanor and the behavior of people whether they're really trying to move things forward or whether they're just stalling, for example. So you got to learn about human behavior and behaviors in those kinds of situations. But believe me, by the end of the Paris peace talks, we all knew each other pretty damn well, whether we reached agreement or not.
All those hours in the safe house, yeah.
Yeah, but all those hours in our safe house, their safe house, and the plenary sessions. I mean, we knew each other, no question. And we were not unfriendly with each other. We may have had frustrations, and we may not always have been happy with what we were hearing or living through, but that's what diplomacy is about. You got to be professional about it, and I think we were. We were on both sides. I mean, Le Duc Tho was the leader of the North Vietnamese delegation, and he was a member of the Politburo, and he's a man who'd been in the trenches for years, and he was a strong party leader, and then his number two was a career diplomat. He was the foreign minister, and he'd been in the foreign ministry for years and years and years. So we had both a Paul, a guy who was basically a party member, high-level communist official, and we had a guy who knew something about diplomacy.
Is there someone that you could imagine refusing to meet if you were still a diplomat, and someone, like, is anyone beyond the pale, or could you see as a diplomat that your role is to engage and?
Well, that's why you have such a thing as instructions. I mean, these are not rules you make up yourself. I mean, if the U.S. government doesn't want to deal with some party or group or faction, you'll know about it and you won't violate the government's policy. I mean, Andy Young, the late Ambassador Andrew Young, who was, Jimmy Carter's ambassador to the United Nations, he met with the Palestinian delegation in New York back in the 1970s without Jimmy Carter's permission at a time that the Palestinians were still sort of in the penalty box, right, as far as we were concerned. And that ultimately led to his resignation.
Wow.
There are rules. You don't go around and arrogate these things to yourself. If it's a serious matter, you can be sure somebody above you has thought about it and probably created a rule that you have to observe. I mean, I think countries expect you to carry out your government's instructions.
They know you're acting on the government's behalf.
They don't hear that much about your personal opinion. They want to know if you're representing accurately and faithfully representing your government.
So that is the key role of diplomacy. Do you feel like at the moment it's being sidelined in favor of other, more of a stick approach rather than a carrot or less on the engagement side? And what would it take to resurrect it, if so?
Well, that's a great question. If you could get some of these things going, the president has created this board of peace. I don't know where that's going to go. I mean, if he has in mind substituting for the Security Council, I think he has another thought coming, really. I don't think that's going to necessarily accomplish that. I think people who join it now are doing it probably to the countries that have joined are probably just trying to please Mr. Trump. But, we could get some serious conversation going at some point. That's not out of the question. You could certainly see something to try and improve the situation in Gaza and in the Israeli-Palestinian relationship. I hope we don't give up on that. I thought our position on a Palestinian, I was present when we voted. In fact, I was one of the drafters of a resolution that recognized the vision of a Palestinian state living at peace with its neighbor Israel.
When was that?
Must be around 2002, maybe. Resolution 1397, I'm pretty sure. A UN Security Council resolution. And I called up Colin Powell at 11 o'clock at night. I said, the Arab group has asked me if I would accept that language in the preamble. And if we do, then we can pass this resolution. And Powell said, well, call David Satterfield. David was the assistant secretary for...
I remember him from Iraq.
Yeah. Hey, call Satterfield, and if he agrees, you go ahead and vote for it. And so I called Satterfield, and he said, oh, yeah, that's standard language. With standard language, we'd never manage to get into a UN Security Council resolution. So I got it. And then that night, and the Arab group was very happy. It was led at the time by the Jordanian ambassador. But the Syrians, who were on the Security Council, said, oh, we don't know. We may not be able to vote for it. I don't have instructions from Bashar al-Assad. I have to wait till tomorrow morning. So we were all very disappointed that we couldn't pass it that night. But we went back to the Security Council that morning around 9 o'clock, sat around the Security Council table, and guess what? The Syrian seat was empty. He couldn't get instructions or something. But anyway, they just simply, so the vote was whatever it was, 14-0 with one abstention. They left their seat empty. I don't know what problem they had with it. I've taken it for granted that that recognition of the Palestinian right to exist as a state was something that every Arab state took for granted. But we got it through.
Nice. And too bad that it hasn't, panned out. I do want to get into, I know we talked about it a bit, about the parallels, especially from your experience as ambassador to Iraq, what parallels or differences do you see between the Iraq and the Iran campaign? And really, the real question is, are there lessons learned from Iraq that you wish the Trump administration had heeded?
I haven't given that issue much thought. I gave a great deal of thought, because I'd served in Vietnam, to the parallels or not. Between Vietnam and Iraq. And I applied them mostly to the way we were organized. I remember how our embassy, how closely it worked with the military command, MACV, how closely Ambassador Bunker, who was our ambassador in Vietnam, worked with General Westmoreland. And I tried to emulate some of that, because they really did collaborate very, very well together. And so things like General Casey, who was the commanding general, he had an office in my complex.
Right across the hall, yeah.
Now, he had his own, military compound and all, but he also spent a decent part of his day downtown with me so that we could compare notes all along. So I always felt we were very much in sync as to what we were doing, and I thought that was very important. So how we organized for the conflict was an issue. When you get into other things, each country, each situation, believe it or not, you look at the way warfare gets conducted and you say, well, why at the beginning of the war do they have so much difficulty figuring out what to do? And it's true in Iraq, it's true in Vietnam. And it turns out that every single conflict is unique enough that you start out on a learning curve.
The war games don't always simulate what's going to happen.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And so, lo and behold, usually towards the end of these conflicts, you pretty much know what you're doing, and you're more effective. And I think that was true in Vietnam. I think it was true in Iraq. But, parallels with one or the other, and the situations are very different. And Iran is that's a completely new situation for us. We've never really been, I don't think, in sort of open conflict with them until now. And, we'll have to see what happens. But it's, they're going up the escalatory ladder, aren't they? And I think that's what worries a lot of people. I mean, where does it end? Where does it stop?
I do appreciate the idea of the planning, and that is the role of the State Department. You know, and I remember some general, he was with Condi Rice. Oh, what's his name? He's written a bunch of books on nuclear de-escalation. And we were watching her be interviewed. And he said, you know, with the Marshall Plan and after World War II, or getting into World War II, there was years of planning about our involvement, our role, what that would look like. And if you think about Iraq, there was so much, you know, a few months of planning. And then I look at today and I wonder if any planning went on.
I think that's fair. You look at Venezuela, for example, I get the feeling the planning didn't go beyond, you know, capturing Mr. Maduro, because I got the sense that Mr. Trump afterwards sort of spent the night thinking about what he was going to say and do next. You remember? And it was about getting democracy back and this and that. And then he woke up the following morning and it was all about oil. That's a great question. And I think a valid point that you do need planning.
Especially when lives are on the line. And like you said, that every leader does take that seriously. But I sometimes question that in the current environment.
Although he hasn't sent combat troops.
But the Marines are on their way.
Well, they're floating around. Yeah, they're floating around. I'd be surprised. You know, I'd think that's something Mr. Trump doesn't want to do if he can help it. I really do believe that, but we'll have to see. I mean, he's the one making the decisions.
One other question about, since I've left Washington, you know, being in that milieu, there was such a sense of crisis. Everything's reactionary. It's crisis driven. There's the political angle. And it all feels, you know, like you're in a bubble and that everything you're doing is the most important thing going on in the world. And granted, like, look at the decisions we're making as a country and how it is rippling out into the world. So I'm not minimizing that at all. But also now being outside of that bubble, you know, there's the saying, change doesn't come from Washington, it comes to Washington. And I feel like the deeper cultural shifts that need to happen, like let's say even just this culture of violence that exists in the U.S., whether that's our gun laws, you know, domestically or the wars that we export, that culture, the cultural change has to shift from the grassroots and then eventually come to Washington. So I guess my question for you is, on these questions of war and peace, what are the real pressure points, would you say, you know, towards government? Like, how can civil society influence a foreign policy establishment that oftentimes seems really insulated, but we know is not impervious to, you know, grassroots pressure or cultural change? So I wondered if you had any reaction to that.
Yeah, I do. I think it's through political action of various kinds, but that's where, as we were talking about earlier, that's where the midterm elections, for example, come in. And as you know, well, first of all, let's go back to basics. We're quite a divided, evenly divided society. It's amazing how close elections can be and how close to 50-50 these votes are in many, many different places. You know, a state is blue and a state is red, but how red and how blue? And sometimes it's very, very, very close indeed. And I think that's where we're at in the states at the moment. And we've been there for quite a long time. So I don't know what's going to happen in these midterms, but I have a feeling that the Republicans are certainly going to lose, I believe, the House and may lose the Senate. And, you know, with that, in and of itself, I think you have the potential of seeing quite a bit of change. And then you'll be in a position to influence whatever the new lineup is in the Congress. But yes, political action is extraordinarily important.
And other than voting, what would you say? I mean, what do you think about marches and protests or lobbying or pressure on your representatives? I mean, it's hard to just tell people, oh, let's just vote every couple of years and that's the extent.
Well, there's writing, there's, you know, you can affect our country intellectually as well through various forms, whether it's film or written work. Gosh knows, this country is very, people express themselves a lot. And why not? Have at it in whatever way you know how to do. It seems to me, the pity would be if people started losing interest in these questions and just let the, you know, let just things happen.
The apathy is maybe a much greater danger than...
Apathy is dangerous. It's a danger.
And numbness, too, and distraction, especially with media now and our phones, and people are so inundated with information and entertainment that they are taking less of an interest, or they feel it's either they're overwhelmed and or they feel powerless. And so how can the average person feel that they're making a difference?
This is not a complete answer, but don't underestimate your own power to think for yourself, for goodness sake. I mean, we can't just hand this all over, especially in today's world, to these politicians who are sometimes seem to be fighting a different fight than you and I are. You know, think for yourself and express yourself. Find ways to do that. I mean, there still are people who do that. Maybe it's too confusing. Maybe with modern communications, there are too many different opinions flying around. I don't know. But I reserve the right to have my own opinion, it seems to me. And that I hope everybody else does too.
Well said.
You don't have to agree with person X, Y, or Z. After all, these subjects can be studied. They can be understood. You can read about them. You can write about them.
And there are so many ways to express one's opinion. I mean, look at the proliferation of podcasts, of influencers. I mean, there certainly are. Sometimes I feel like everyone's talking and no one's listening.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. And maybe sometimes there are too many opinions out there. I don't know. But it's a confusing time. There's no question about it. And I think the multiplicity of ways of communicating and the multiplicity of media and all has also become a serious challenge. Just so many opinions out there.
But this, what you just said about think for yourself, don't abdicate either your responsibility or your voice.
Well, you're a citizen. You're a citizen. You know how to read and write, and you went to high school at least. I mean, why not?
I've got to ask you these two because these are my favorite, but it really is, and I'm really interested in your opinion because I know that traditionally, you know, the U.S. foreign policy is U.S. here, our national interests, and you as a diplomat, you know, we're furthering national interests, and then there's the world out there. But the world has changed, as we know, with globalization and this interdependence that we're seeing, that really, where now do you draw the line between our interests and their interests? But it really is, it may be a different even language, you know, mutuality of interest, shared interests. But what does that look like for you? Has it changed the meaning of national interest? And when will institutions, if ever, catch up to that reality of a globalized, interconnected, interdependent world?
Well, one of the ways of doing it is to have diplomats and to have them stationed around the world and looking, being the eyes and ears of the United States, representing us, but also reporting back to Washington what things are like out there. And I don't know how much respect or attention Mr. Trump has really given to diplomatic efforts. And he's certainly been, they've not been supportive of our professional diplomats. I mean, people who have been administering our aid programs. I mean, that's the first thing they went after. They abolished AID, which I thought was not a responsible act. And I think I know what prompted it. There's this myth out there amongst people who don't know better that somehow our foreign aid program absorbs 20 or 30% of the U.S. national product. I mean, they were just convinced. And so I think when they abolished AID, they thought there was going to be this huge dividend that was going to come from abolishing AID. And it turned out to be a drop in the bucket. It was nothing because our aid is less than, 1% or something of our overall budget. It was really very unfortunate that people felt that way. But as a result, a whole agency basically got eliminated. And they're going after the career foreign service in the same way. Lots of people have quit because, they don't appoint any career people anymore, hardly any. to become ambassadors. Well, why could, you know, you did all your study, you went and got a master's degree, you managed to pass the Foreign Service exam, and then you're told, sorry, the top positions in our department will probably not be available to you just because you're a Foreign Service officer. Now, that's really unfair. It's wrong.
And Ambassador, how do those steps and those measures come back to, yes, it's aid towards other countries, but how does taking an approach like that come back to affect the U.S.?
Well, I mean, you lose friends, for one. It's not a good way to make friends and influence people, cut off the aid programs, especially when you cut programs that are helping countries that are suffering real challenges, you know, starvation, displacement of people, internal refugees.
Or even potential extremists. You know, you cut aid to that, and then they're going to get aid from other places, less savory countries.
Yeah, or none at all, which is even worse. And then people just suffer, and then cutting aid to the United Nations. I mean, it's ludicrous. The United Nations budget is, again, a drop in the bucket compared to, you know, any budgets that we have. I mean, we gave, I think, a total of $8 billion to peacekeeping efforts and something like that. And, you know, we have an almost $1 trillion Pentagon budget. And what we give to peacekeeping at the UN is just practically nothing. It's a rounding error. And yet we cut that off. And actually, we had some successes. I mentioned several of them in Africa that we've had. And those are people who are serving there in lieu of, you know, imagine if we had to send American troops instead, how much more costly it would be to conduct those peacekeeping efforts. Maybe those peacekeepers aren't as proficient as ours, you might argue, but still, we don't have to pay for the cost of Americans to carry out UN peacekeeping missions because there are plenty of other countries that are willing to do that. Mr. Rumsfeld, who was a fairly controversial Secretary of Defense, but I remember after about a year as Secretary in the Bush 2 administration, and he came to me and he said, I'm all for this peacekeeping at the UN. He said, I just want to train them so that they're more proficient and let me have a shot at training some of them. And so we did. We built in a training program for UN peacekeepers, which was quite effective. So, I mean, even someone as hard-nosed as Donald Rumsfeld understood the value for the United States to support UN peacekeeping.
And it goes back to our aims. I mean, I've tried to figure out why is war a $1 trillion industry when we say we want peace? But everyone in the peace field, the budgets are slashed, they're underfunded, they're under-legitimized, they're under-supported. But that's what we say we want is peace, but we're funding the opposite. And so to go in and you know, slash these budgets of aid, of the State Department, of the diplomatic wing, to me, as what I think is a sensible person, it goes against reason to say we want one thing, but we are funding and supporting the direct opposite. But we say we want peace, and we're not funding the infrastructure of peace. And not even just peacekeeping, but actually the peace builders at the grassroots. And that seems nonsensical to me.
Yeah, I think also they maybe ought to give more credit to the people during World War II and at the end of World War II who planned for the creation of the United Nations and all the institutions around it. They weren't a bunch of woke, I don't know what. I mean, you know, these were serious people working on behalf of the United States and trying to build a new proper world order after World War II, after these frightful wars.
And in a way, it was sort of prescient, their move, because that was before the world did really become globalized and interconnected financially and all the ways that we are. And so, but it sort of set in place a mechanism or a structure that could deal effectively in today's world, which is very different.
Yeah, and there are a few other pieces where built later and attached to the system, but I like the trading, you know, the GATT and then the World Trade Organization and so forth.
And even EU becoming the EU. I mean, it's just fascinating how much more integration.
But, you know, you can get some Americans going on these very subjects, the EU or the WTO, and they don't necessarily like them, but there we are. It's just we're at a period now where I think we've gone too far in seeking to discredit the old institutions without necessarily putting anything more valuable in their place.
And I would say that we're also going too far with this resurgence of the idea that might makes right, that that's sort of a worldview that in my mind is outdated. And for example, Ambassador, that's why this podcast is called Peace is Power, because it's positing an alternative to that, that the idea of dominance and aggression, the alternative to that worldview. And what we're trying to say is that actually working in harmony with others in this globalized world, working for shared values and benefits will ultimately help us, our security, our economy, and it's ultimately more sustainable and successful. So I would love to ask, when you hear that, does that resonate with you or are there tweaks that you would make?
No, it resonates, but you're not going to gain majority acceptance of that approach in the current political context. So
we have a lot of work to do. And I would say even the cultural idea, I think that there is a sense that, yes, you know, we have to be strong to be safe and secure. It is a dog-eat-dog world. Like, those are almost these underlying myths that I reject. And I think that we need to be putting out alternative narratives to that if we do want people to see, oh, maybe there's another way. Maybe we can actually be more sustainable, more successful, and not hurt our neighbor, but help our neighbor. So to see examples of that.
But I think it's a good idea if you're going to espouse, what I talked about at the beginning, good governance, that you incorporate in your notion of good governments a sound defense posture. I'm not saying an aggressive one or anything else, but I think you want to be healthy from a defense point of view as well. I mean, look at a country like Switzerland. No one thinks of Switzerland as a bellicose country, and it's not. But look at the effort they devoted in order to protect their neutrality during World War II, the effort they devoted to strengthening their own defenses so that if Germany were ever to try to invade them, the Germans would really pay a price. And if you ever look at Swiss defenses, well, I would say for a country its size, they're quite formidable, but they're truly defensive. And, you know, they have tank traps all over the country. They have all sorts of things. They have little places inside mountains from which jet aircraft can take off. I mean, you know, if you look at the whole thing, they've put a lot of thought into how to defend themselves. And I'm not saying that dominates their budget or anything, but it's an important factor. So,
and it's certainly not viewed as aggressive. You know, a lot of countries call defense forces, but really it is aggressive.
No, the Swiss are thought of quite differently, right? It's where the Red Cross was founded and so on and so forth.
They've somehow gotten that balance right.
Yeah.
Okay, my final question. Are you ready?
I was waiting for the final question.
It's very simple, but kind of not. What does peace mean to you?
Well, I think peace to me means when the countries of the world live in harmony with each other and do not have to worry about the imminent or immediate threat of some kind of aggressive behavior from one neighbor or another. And that efforts are continuously made to maintain international mechanisms that contribute towards the maintenance of peace. How about that?
Thank you so much. I actually was asked recently and I'm like, gosh, I don't even know how I would put it into words. And I've been trying to think about that. That's really at the core of this. What do we even mean? What is the goal? And then how do we get there?
Yeah. And the word respect has to come into it too. That it's that these countries have to respect each other and their right to exist. It's a little message for Israel and Iran.
I know I took so much of your time, Ambassador, but this was so helpful and a nice chance for me to ask you these questions I've long wanted to ask you. And I really appreciate you taking the time on a whole bevy of subjects that we covered. Thank you so much. Before we go, here's our peace practice for this week. I hope you can open Google Maps and find your little blue dot on there, then keep zooming out past your street, your city, your country, until you can see the whole Earth. And we see there that it's one world, one tiny shared blue planet floating in space. Then zoom back in, not to home, but somewhere foreign to you. I want you to find a river in another country, one you've never thought much about. You might want to look up a photo of it, learn one fact about it. And as we do, we can remember that all the rivers of the Earth are connected, just as our water is connected. Our peace practice today is the gift of attention that can turn a distant place into part of the same living whole. Join me next time on Peace is Power. Thank you so much for listening. If this show speaks to you, please follow it. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast, and share it with someone who needs to hear it. Every follow, review, and share helps more people discover the show and helps spread the power of peace a little further.